Welcome to this IFRS Foundation podcast, which will focus on the July meeting of the International Accounting Standards Board. The meeting took place in London on the 17th and 18th of July 2018. My name is Matt Tilling and I'm the Director of Education here at the Foundation. Today I am joined by the Chair of the Board, Hans Hoogevoest, and Vice Chair Sue Lloyd to talk through the latest meeting and other developments. And Hans, this really was a historic board meeting.
Yeah, that's correct. It was the last board meeting to be held at Cannon Street. The ISB has been based at Cannon Street for 17 years. So many hours of board discussions have taken place at this address and have been webcast from this address. So we'll be sorry to leave, but we are moving to a very good new location in Canary Wharf in offices that will better meet the needs of a 21st century standard setter. And the next board meeting is in September in that new office.
Well, let's start with the board's discussion on goodwill and impairment. Some important decisions were made at this month's board meeting.
Yeah, so this is all part of a post-implementation review, which we have been conducting very thoroughly. We've had many discussions and we continue to hone our objective, which will inform the ongoing work on this project. First of all, we have decided that we will not try to remove the differences between accounting requirements for internally generated intangible assets and those for intangible assets acquired in a business combination. What we have decided to do is that we are most likely going forward with a discussion paper in which we will first of all look at how disclosures can be improved to help investors to assess more effectively if a business combination was a good investment or not. And we also will look at a couple of ways of improving and making easier the calculation of value in use, which you need to do for an impairment assessment. Now, during the deliberations and analysis of the staff papers, it became increasingly clear that impairment is not only a costly exercise, but that it is also relatively ineffective, mainly because of the shielding effect of internally generated goodwill of existing assets. So when you're doing an impairment assessment, you are not only assessing whether the goodwill of acquired assets is still there, you're also looking at the goodwill, the internally generated goodwill of existing assets. So that means that the impairment is always bound to be too late. And we have always been aware of this issue, but it has become increasingly clear that it's probably a very big issue. So in the discussion paper, we will try to look at ways of making perhaps the whole process a bit simpler and more effective. There are several things we are looking at to make goodwill accounting simpler. For example, we don't plan to require immediate write-off of goodwill on initial recognition. We don't believe that would provide good information for investors. But we will continue to look at the possibility of reintroducing amortization. And should we do so, then we can also look at possible relief from the annual impairment testing of goodwill to make the task less onerous and less costly for companies. But I do want to say this is all going to take place in the context of a discussion paper, so we are very far from decision making. It could also be that ultimately we would consider that reintroduction of amortization provides so little benefit that we would leave the situation as it is.
Sue, the board also spent a bit of time discussing rate regulated activities, particularly the accounting model that is being developed.
That's right, and the main focus of the discussion this month was on when there's a significant financing component and how the discount rate should be determined when there is a significant financing component. And the board decided that if a regulatory agreement doesn't provide explicit compensation for the time value of money, an entity should use judgment to determine whether there's a significant financing component, taking into account their own facts and circumstances. If a company concludes that the financing component isn't significant, then discounting of the future cash flows wouldn't be required. But if a company concludes that the financing component is significant, then the company should use what we described as a reasonable rate to discount the estimated future cash flows and recognise any loss in P&L immediately. The board decided that when a financing component is explicit in the agreement, that the entity should use that rate to discount the estimated future cash flows. And that would be the case unless there was clear evidence that showed that the interest rate that has been established either provides an excess or a deficit in compensation. And if that were the case, the entity should recognise the excess or the deficit in compensation in the period when the identifiable event or decision occurs.
Hans, there was quite a long session on the disclosure initiative, and a key part of this was really about drafting of the standards rather than their technical content, and in other words, the use of language in standards. And though this might seem a bit of an odd topic, it's obviously very critical to the work that we do here.
Yeah, well, it is sometimes a bit underappreciated that board and staff do not just have to be very good technical accountants, but that they also have to be able to translate that technical knowledge into accounting standards that are being capable of being read well and that are understandable to people across the country borders, being used in many countries with many different languages and cultures, and that with the clarity that they provide, that the standards should also be enforceable. And this all requires very clear and unambiguous language. So from time to time, it is useful for us to reflect on how we write our standards, and that was indeed a big part of this discussion. So the board has decided that when, and specifically we've been talking about drafting disclosure objectives and requirements, and we've decided that in doing so in the future we should use only prescriptive language, i.e. using the word shall, to require entities to comply with disclosure objectives in the standards. So the disclosure objectives have to be very clear, and then we also have to clearly say that is what thou shalt do. However, when referring to specific items of information for disclosure, we plan to use less prescriptive language. We will, for example, use words shall consider, because when you're talking about specific items, they can be very different from company to company, and the materiality can be very different from company to company. So we've also decided to take steps to maximize the use of consistent language across disclosure requirements in the standards. For example, by avoiding to use the same term in different ways across the standards. And if different meanings for the same term are unavoidable, consider whether additional guidance and explanation is needed. We will also state the intended location when using the terms present or disclose in disclosure requirements in IFRS standards to be clear whether we mean on the face of the primary financial statements or in the notes. That is not always clear thus far. We have also decided that when drafting disclosure objectives and requirements in the future, that the board shall seek advice, including from our own IFRS taxonomy team, to identify a relationship between the disclosure proposals and our existing requirements. And thus, we hope to minimize duplication of disclosure requirements between our standards. Last but not least, the board has decided to select two standards that we will use to test whether we can improve our disclosure requirements using this new approach to drafting. And we chose IAS 19, employee benefits, and IFRS 13, fair value measurement. So a relatively old standard and a relatively new standard. And our stakeholders have supported this decision. They told us that both could do with improvement to the disclosure requirements. So we hope that they will be a very good test case for some of the ideas that we want to trial.
Sue, the board also talked about some of the work being done by the Interpretations Committee, which you chair. There's quite a lot happening there, isn't there?
Always. So the board received an update on the May and June meetings of the Interpretations Committee, And so I'll just highlight a few of the things that we looked at in particular. So one of the important things that the board discussed was the recommendations that the Interpretations Committee have made to propose a narrow scope amendment to IAS 37, provisions and contingent liabilities and assets standard. And specifically, the proposed amendment relates to clarifying what costs need to be considered when an entity is making the assessment of whether a contract is onerous or not. And the board agreed with the committee's recommendations that to make this assessment, the cost of fulfilling a contract that's referred to in the standard should comprise the costs that relate directly to the contract. Now, what that phrase, you know, cost relating directly to the contract means is really important if it's going to be the factor that you need to consider to decide what an onerous contract is. So to be sure that we have got clarity in what that term means, the board agreed with the committee's recommendation that we should include some examples in the draft amendments to illustrate what types of costs would be considered to be directly related to a contract. The board agreed with the committee that we shouldn't propose any new disclosure requirements about onerous contracts. And in terms of the approach to transition, the board agreed to propose that entities be required to apply the proposed amendments to contracts that exist at the beginning of the annual reporting period in which the entity first applies the amendments, so a type of prospective application. The other topic related to the committee that the board discussed was transactions involving commodities and cryptocurrencies. And the discussion focused on the prevalence of transactions involving commodities and cryptocurrencies for entities that use our standards and possible narrow scope standard setting activities that we might undertake. In relation to commodities, the board decided to consider at a future meeting whether it would be feasible to do a narrow scope standard setting project to look just specifically at commodity loan transactions. So the staff are going to go away and look at whether it's actually possible to scope in such a focused way. And the board decided not to add to its work plan a project to develop a more all-encompassing investment standard at the moment. On the crypto front, the board decided to ask the Interpretations Committee to do some more analysis for us, to provide us with some more information about how entities might apply our existing standards to determine the accounting for their holdings of cryptocurrencies and to account for transactions when they make initial coin offerings. So the committee will do some more analysis with the staff and then report back to the board, and then we'll decide at a subsequent meeting what, if anything, we want to do on the crypto front.
Hans, before we finish, I think it's worth mentioning a couple of other events that have taken place in the past month. First of these, during July, we announced the membership of the Management Commentary Consultative Group.
Yes, so we discussed earlier that the board has decided to make an update of the Management Commentary Practice Statement, which is an important part of our better communication in financial reporting work stream. And we have indeed appointed a consultative group, a group of specialists from preparer backgrounds, investor backgrounds, regulators. This group of people will help us by providing input to our work from their expertise background. I think we've got a good mix of backgrounds and expertise on it from around the world, so this group will undoubtedly be extremely helpful. This is something we do normally with a new project to make sure that we get all the information that we need.
And the second piece of news that's obviously quite a big announcement for the Foundation is the appointment of a new chair to the trustees.
Yes, so the trustees are the oversight body for the IASB. They're a group of 22 people from around the world with a big mix of backgrounds. They're in charge of the oversight of the board. They appoint the board members. They check that the board follows the agreed due process in our standard setting, and they determine the overall strategy for the foundation. Since 2011, the board of trustees has been chaired by Michel Prada, and unfortunately his term is now up. He did a fantastic job chairing the trustees, and I was able to work very closely with him. But we are also happy to have found an excellent successor, Mr. Erkki Liikanen, who is the former governor of the Finnish Central Bank. But not, he doesn't only have that background. He has also been a politician early in his career. He's also been a commissioner in the European Union. So he's got a very wide background. He knows a lot of people who are important to our work. So we are looking forward to working with him in the future.
Well, that brings us to the end of the July podcast. Thank you, Hans and Sue, and thank you to our listeners. There's no board meeting in August, so the next time we record this will be in September. But any feedback on these podcasts, please email communications@ifrs.org. And as always, a full summary of the board's discussion and decisions at the July meeting can be found in the ISB update on the IFRS Foundation's website. Talk to you all in September.